Representative Tuck, Seaton, Co-Chair Johnson, Newman, and Representative Olson. Today before us, we're very fortunate to have with us today a couple of fine senators. I was going to say they're the only two, but
that'd be
most of them. All the fine senators are with us today.
Two favorites.
We're going to start today with SB 195. And I got them out of order on my list. We're going to start with SB 195, an act relating to. I'm going to retract that, Senator Thomas, because I promised Senator Egan he could go first. Senator Egan, if you'd join us for SJR 27, which I see is co-sponsored by the whole Senate. So this is, if there's ever a reason for us not to pass a piece of legislation, this could be it.
Don't
just say no. Senator Egan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think you have an excellent committee as well. And thank you. And I appreciate you hearing Senate Joint Resolution 27. SJR 27 urges Congress to spend more on marketing domestic seafood, including the state of Alaska. As Alaskans, we all know where our seafood comes from, and we get the added benefit of supporting our fisheries economy. Our fish are wild and fresh, but don't have to travel very far to reach plates. But nationally, the story is totally different. In the United States, over 80% of the seafood they eat is imported. Each year, the federal government collects hundreds of millions of dollars in duties on the imported fish and fish products that so aggressively compete with America's seafood. Yet seafood producers receive only insignificant funds for domestic marketing and product development. This resolution calls for some of the taxes collected on imported fish being put toward marketing American seafood to Americans. In our state, marketing investments in the Alaska seafood industry have meant economic development and support for an industry so vital to Alaska's economy and future. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would appreciate your support on SJR 27, and as the chair pointed out, it passed the Senate unanimously.
Thank you, Senator Egan. I'd like to recognize that Representative Guttenberg has joined us. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
And by the way, Mr. Chair, Alita Buss on my staff is here to answer any questions that I can't figure out.
Okay. And before we start, Representative Wilson has joined us as well. So, Representative Newman.
Thank you. Senator Egan, is there a way to, or maybe it says it in a way in here, that we can also ask for Alaska's wild seafood to be recognized in a highlighted fashion? I know that's your goal.
Through the chair, Representative Newman, that's the whole thrust of this Senate Joint Resolution, and we would be more than willing to, you know, accept some amendment from the committee.
Follow up,
Representative Newman.
Certainly don't mean to amend it in the Resources Committee here. I know that it's certainly a high priority of yours. Just in the title where it talks about, you know, provide funding for domestic seafood marketing, there's domestic farmed fish, or other seafoods that could be used underneath those headings, you know. And I know that certainly your intent and desire to highlight Alaska's wild seafood. And I think we're on line five where it talks where 80% of the total seafood, fish and seafood consumed in the United States is currently originating foreign. But I think all the wilds, salmon, almost half of that comes from Alaska, doesn't it? I believe.
Actually, through the chair, Representative Newman, we have had statistics that it's more than half. However, federal funds that go toward marketing other seafood, we get minuscule amounts of funding for Alaska to market Alaskan seafood, and this is the thrust of this Senate Joint Resolution and at the request of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions for the sponsor? We have online Bruce Wallace from Juneau with the UFA, who's for questions only. Representative Egan, or Senator Egan, I'm sorry, I promoted you already. If you'd just sit there for a second, we'll see if there's any public testimony. Do we have any public testimony online?
No.
Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this resolution? Hearing and seeing none, we will close public testimony. Committee discussion. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like the idea of using federal marine fishery import tariffs to enhance our fisheries, so.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. It's always good to use someone else's money. Representative Tuck.
Always.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say the same thing. It's nice when foreign companies are paying for our marketing. One of the things, I've never been to Japan, but one of the things I understand is that our meat departments here in America, is their fish departments over there, and our fish departments, which happen to be really small, is their meat departments. And I think Americans would live much better if they eat more fish. And so I think this is good, and more Alaskan fish, even more importantly. So thanks for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
For the resolution.
Any other questions or comments of the resolution sponsor? I think we'll set this aside. No, just...
Mr. Chair, before you get there.
Before we get there. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 27, Resources, version /R, from committee with any individual recommendations or attached fiscal notes.
Thank you. Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, so moved. Senator Egan, thank
Mr.
you so
Chair,
much for
members
going
of the committee, thank you.
Thank you. We will now move to Senate Bill number 195.
Senator.
Senator Thomas, if you would join us, please.
Thank you.
Another highly complicated piece of legislation, I see.
I'll try and explain it simplistically.
Okay.
good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the rest of the committee. Senator Joe Thomas, District D, Fairbanks, the Interior, Denali Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough. Senate Bill 195 is purpose is to remove the sunset provision from the Goldstream Public Use Area. The Goldstream Public Use Area was created in 1990 by Representative Mike Davis and Senator Betty Fahrenkamp to preserve the recreational opportunities, traditional uses, and atmosphere of the local neighborhoods. The Goldstream Public Use Area is set to sunset July 1st, 2010, unless Senate Bill 195 passes in this legislative session. Public use area encompasses a patchwork of nearly 2,000 acres of state land. Goldstream Public Use Area is home to an ever-growing network of trails that connect users to the Chattanooga River Valley, the White Mountains, and the Fairbanks area, all from a central location close to the Fairbanks North Star Borough's population base and minutes from downtown Fairbanks. The Goldstream Public Use Area is passively managed by the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Mining, Lands, and Water, and allows all uses, including hunting, snow machining, mining, trapping, dog mushing. Basically, everything from berry picking to mining is permitted. The trails are maintained by volunteers at no cost to the taxpayers. Senate Bill 195 is actively supported by the following organizations: the Alaska Outdoor Council, the Alaska Dog Mushers Association, the Alaska Miners Association, the Nordic Ski Club of Fairbanks, Alaska Trappers Association, Ski Juring and Polk Association, Fairbanks Snow Travelers, Northern Area State Parks Advisory Board, Fairbanks North Star Borough Trails Advisory Board. Your packet contains letters from each of these organizations, and also additionally there are nearly 200 individuals that have written letters of support. This area, which is used most heavily in the winter by wide and diverse user groups, has been described by the Fairbanks Daily News Miner as a, quote, central park for the Goldstream neighborhoods. The companion House Bill 250 is sponsored by Representatives Mike Kelly and David Guttenberg. I would also like to take a moment to thank my constituents, Richard and Mary Bishop, for their support and hard work for the Goldstream Public Use Area over the years. Mr. Bishop, the immediate past president of the Alaska Outdoor Council and a great Alaska outdoorsman, was the original impetus for the Goldstream Public Use Area. He approached his representative back in 1989 about creating this area, which would be available to all of the Alaska outdoor enthusiasts, no matter what their interest. Mr. Bishop was also the one who alerted me to this area's impending sunset. Unfortunately, he was not able to testify here today. I urge you to join me in supporting Alaska's recreation and access opportunities and vote yes on Senate Bill 195. And I would answer any questions you may have. And also, no, we'll leave all this information aside. You have.
Thank you, Senator. Could I get you to read those 200 letters?
You can, yeah.
We're just having fun at this.
That's okay. That's good.
Any questions of the bill sponsor? Representative Newman.
Just to give him a chance to break here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Thomas. You know, the way I read this and what I like about this is the fact it's a multi-use trail. You know, open to all user groups, whether ATVs, horse riding, hiking, you know, photography, lots of wonderful people getting out there. And just want to make sure we're on the record here, and you can talk to the folks there about how many people use this and that it is a multi-use trail. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? With that, I would like to open. I'm sorry, Representative Tuck, I'm sorry.
And just real quick, if you don't mind, Senator, if you just on this map that you have provided, is it within the black boundaries? Is it within the blue boundaries? Is it within the green dotted boundaries?
It is the all of the areas that I'm not sure what map I might
all
have
blue areas.
Here to look
blue
at.
Areas. Okay.
It's all the areas within the blue. That's correct. It's all the several or the variety of chunks that stretch from one from the area over near Fox all the way to the over to the Murphy Dome Road.
And so some of it is broken up just a little bit.
It is broken up. It's all. It's not a contiguous piece of property. That's correct. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I know you've probably been through this, but the bill title is an act relating to the repeal of the establishment of the Goldstream Public Use Area.
Remove the sunset provision from the Goldstream. Oh, I'm not looking at the bill. I'm looking at my notes.
So yeah, it repeals a section, but the title says it repeals the establishment of the Goldstream. And I want to make sure that you're comfortable with that, and that we're not doing something that you would not want to have happen. And I'm not big on the title change. You tell me it's okay, and it's okay.
Well, you know, we probably should look at that. We didn't actually write the title, so we'll take a careful look at making sure that, in fact, it reflects what we want to do. It should be an act relating to the repeal of the sunset of the Goldstream Public Use Area, I believe, would be more accurate.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure that your staff, maybe, or yourself, and when you work with legal on this, and a lot of people that we talked, that's the question I asked my chair about this. I didn't see that. But if Section 1, where it says on line 3 of page 1 of the bill, that Section 1 is repealed. So if the sunset date is Section 1, maybe that deals with it there without a title change, or I don't want to make the mistake here and, you know, make sure that we don't get rid of the Goldstream Public Use Area.
Certainly not our intention.
Sunset date of Section 1, then they're probably covered.
We'll talk to Ledge Legal and make sure that we, they wrote it, so they understood exactly what we're trying to do. We'll make sure that we.
And I think for the record, we want to make sure that it's our intention not to repeal that we're right. Strictly talking the sunset date. We don't want to do something that's, and I don't have the whole statute in front of me, so it may be appropriate. Representative Guttenberg, do you?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two copies of version R. One is that title as you read it, and the other one is an act relating to the repeal of the establishment. Oh, no, it is the exact same title. So, I'm sorry, I read it wrong the first time, but we could fix that.
My understanding is we're dealing with /R, and that's okay. That's not right.
That is the one I have before me, and I think we checked carefully to make sure that Section 2, Chapter 48, is in fact the sunset clause. So it may well be that we need to correct the title, but the intention of the bill obviously is to repeal the sunset.
Thank you, yeah. Senator. And that we want to make sure that that's on the record, that that's our intention as well.
Okay.
Are there any questions of the sponsor? Representative Wilson, did you?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else? With that, I would like to go to public testimony. We have Wynn Menefee with DNR for questions only. Ms. Juhas, would you like to join us at the table to testify, or are you here for questions only? Senator, if you'd.
I certainly will. Yield to.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Could you put your name on the record and identify yourself, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Uhoff, and I am the legislative liaison for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And it's not that often that we have an opportunity to give positive testimony on a feel-good issue like this. Goldstream Public Use Area is a model that works. It serves our user base, consumptive and non-consumptive, motorized and non-motorized, and this is a model we'd like to see used more often. The users involved in the original creation of this area were inclusive. They focused on issues that matter to all of the users. And unlike other shared use areas, we really don't see contentious arguments over superfluous issues here. What we see is a benefit to all of our users.
Thank you. Any questions of the department? Thank you, Ms. Uhoff. Oh, wait a minute.
Yes.
Senator Newman, our Representative Newman. Can't have senators in the room. It really ruins me.
Hey, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Ms. Uhoff. Jennifer, and then just reading like some of the statutes here where it talks about some of the brief facts where it says commissioner shall allow Goldstream public use area to include multi-use uses. And I'm assuming that, you know, it would always be the intent to the department to continue that. Have you ever had heard any responses to any changes to that at all? Or I'm assuming it's very widely appreciated.
Through the chair, I have not.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any additional questions of the department? Representative Wilson?
Well, I guess not really questions, but in the packet, it mentions the fact that the state passively manages it because volunteers keep it up, so I think that's pretty nifty.
Yeah, I think they're very proud of their area, and I'm happy to see this. I would like to recognize that Representative Kawasaki joined us some time ago. Sorry for not recognizing you, Representative. Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify? With that, we will go online to Fairbanks. Shirley Liss, are you available?
Yes, I'm here in Fairbanks. This is Shirley Liss.
Would you please identify yourself for the record, who you represent, if anyone, and proceed with your testimony, please.
I'm representing myself, although I did get a call from Dick Bishop, who encouraged me to come and to try and bring other people here. But after hearing the comments that you folks have been making, it seems pretty sure that this bill will pass. I've been a resident in the Valley since 1970, and I've used the Goldstream use area since then, ever since. I've probably put in some of the trails and did a lot of the trail maintenance, and I'm very glad to hear that it looks like this is going to pass. If anything, I would like to see it expanded. Thank you.
One thing at a time, please. Thank you, Shirley. Malcolm McCune in Fairbanks?
Yes, this is Malcolm McCune in Fairbanks.
Would you please proceed with your testimony? Identify if you represent a group or yourself, please.
I represent myself, and I am in support of this SB 195, and I'm encouraged by your testimony in support of this. I've used the trails since 1985 for cycling, ski touring, and photography. I see a lot of other folks out there doing the dog mushing, snow machining, and blueberry picking. And so I would like to see this area stay as the public use area. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McCune? Thank you, Mr. McCune. Is there anyone else online who'd like to testify? And no one else in the room to testify? With that, we will close public testimony. That brings us the bill before us. Any discussion? Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've lived, if you were to draw the line diagonally across this map right through the area, I've lived in that area and mushed dogs and done skied in that area for the past 40 years. And this is, I think, an example of certainly a legacy left over from Fahrenkamp and Davis, but certainly a legacy of the all the multi-users and the ability to get along and work together. And I think it's the repeal of the date is a wonderful thing. And I think the people in this area and all the people that use it, you know, if you'll notice, it has the part of it is the 100-mile loop that includes the large mushing, snow machining, skiing loop that goes right around Fairbanks, and it's a big part of this community, and people use it well together.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Guttenberg, are those your dogs on the trail here?
What's that?
Are these your dogs?
No, I'm sorry, they're not. Or maybe I better look again, knowing who did the picture. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm, you know, as long as the Representative Guttenberg and the sponsor, Senator Thomas, are happy and make sure that this is just a repeal of the sunset and the date, it works for me. And if you would like, we will offer the privilege of maybe moving it to Representative Guttenberg.
Representative Guttenberg, would you like to move this?
I would. I move Senate Bill 195-26-LSO-772/R with individual recommendation.
I don't believe there's a physical note, so attach zero. Are there objections? Hearing and seeing none, so moved. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate you coming in. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman, and the rest of the committee. Appreciate you very much.
Now that the Senate Finance can go back to work, we can go about our business. I feel safer now. That brings before us our favorite bill, 308, at least my favorite bill. When we left off, we had committee discussion. We have some amendments that I would like to get on the table prior to taking public testimony. And as a housekeeping, bit of housekeeping, Representative Seaton, could I get you to remove conceptual amendment number one, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'd withdraw conceptual amendment number one.
Thank you. And just for the record, this is a conceptual amendment that Representative Seaton offered in our last meeting. There is an amendment that's been drafted to the CS that he will be bringing up later. We have online Dan Dickinson to hopefully answer any questions we might have. With that, I would like to offer amendment number two, which is, and Marcia Davis is here too, so we'll be chatting with her as well. Amendment number two is 26LS1328P2.
Object.
And okay. And I'd move that amendment. Representative Kawasaki has objected. What this does is it adds a effective date. Nice. Representative Kawasaki, would you like to speak to your objection?
I want to see where we're at.
Okay. Yeah, we are on / P in case so that everyone knows. And page 9, line 8, following expenditure. Are you with us, Representative Kawasaki?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
No. Representative Kawasaki?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was Representative
Tuck. That's all right. I just want to make sure I'm following the right. So we're withdrawing the conceptual amendment number one.
Correct.
And then we have another amendment being introduced by yourself?
Correct.
Okay.
There'll be several. There'll be Representative Seaton will be reintroducing his amendment that he withdrew, but not conceptual.
Okay.
In writing. So this is an effective date clause. P.2.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Kawasaki, do you maintain your objection?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I actually am just curious the implication of adding this effective date over the total bill's effective dates, and I'm trying to figure out what that actually does.
The purpose for this effective date is to end it in the fiscal year so that we can start July 1 with a clean set of taxes and not carry it in. So we got 2 months of, depending on when it passes, depending on if it's 90 days after April, May, June, it cleans up the date to start it with the end of the calendar year, so we're not overlapping taxation policies.
Okay.
Representative Kawasaki?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking at some of the, in section 19 through 22, some of the other effective date, or actually 18 through 22, on the applicability of these laws, and I think it's maybe a bit confusing, and maybe if we could get Marcia Davis to add 2 cents. I'm curious as to the regulation propagated by these, whether they'll be done at that time, and what the impact is for Department of Revenue and analyzing how much the tax is.
Marsha, would you like to join us? We also have Dan Dickinson online. If he would like to speak to this as well, we'll give him a shot at it.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, this particular amendment obviously is intended to make sure that the credit applies to expenditures that are incurred after June of 2010. And these are this is the tax credit for the well-related expenditures. In order for us to identify what will and won't be considered well-related expenditures, we would in fact have to do regulations if nothing else changes in the bill. However, I believe Chairman Johnson has another amendment pending which may clarify the type of costs that will fall within this credit that perhaps will make much more simplified the identification of the credits or the types of expenditures that would fall within the credit. So the answer to your question will lie in what happens with the other amendment, I think.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Marsha, will you then, I haven't seen the next amendment yet, sorry, I'm just catching up, but for amendment number 2, then, would the department be able to come up with those definitions and the regulations before that date? Is that what, I mean, it looks like this is asking for that.
In terms of the actual procedure it takes, you have to draft them, and then you have to have a period, a 30-day public comment period, and then be able to turn around and have another 30 days for your regulation to be made effective. So there's an absolute, probably bare minimum of maybe 70 days, 80 days in there to get a reg out, get out the door. So I presume if this passes, where are we at now? We probably would be pushing to be able to do that. We might be able to do it.
Virginia Kawasaki.
I'll pass.
Virginia Seaton.
Thank you, Aunt. For Marsha Davis, the question is the taxpayers' tax year July, or is the taxpayers' or in 1st of July, or is it a calendar year?
It represents a seat through the chair. It's a calendar year for the production tax.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It may be problematic since we have a profits-based tax, and the profits are calculated on a yearly basis, and there's only estimated payments made on a monthly basis, I believe, and we're trying to have this. And I may be wrong here, but it seems like we're trying to come back and capture a portion of the profits of the year or credits available. So I'd like to ask the Department of Revenue if this, how much problem this creates, or from.
They're sitting here.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, anytime there's a tax law that sort of has two faces in the midst of a single tax year, it makes it more complicated both for the taxpayer and for the department to administer. It doesn't mean it's insurmountable. I mean, we've done that with respect to when PPT was first passed and ACES was passed. All of those were implemented mid-year. They are a challenge to administer, but it's not impossible to do. But it is a challenge.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Davis, Representative Seaton mentions a profits-based tax. The bill talks about production taxes and credits. And I guess you could look at that in several different ways. Is a profits tax in a production tax, are they the same? Or obviously you don't make a profit until oil or gas is produced. Mm-hmm. So you don't pay taxes until it's produced. So is a production tax and a profits tax the same thing? Or is a profits tax a tax on corporate profits?
Essentially, the way that the current oil and gas production tax is structured, we create a tax rate and we apply that tax rate to a dollar amount. That dollar amount represents what is left over after you take what you sold the product for, deduct the transportation costs, and then deduct what are called lease expenditures, which are all the costs to produce it. So it's intended to represent what is held by the company after they have recovered their cost. So I guess you could say by definition that's the net profit remaining, and the tax rate goes against the net, that net profit that remains. But we don't use the word profit in here. It's called the production tax value at the point of production is the term of art.
Representative Newman.
Thank you. So I think what you said is their expenditures for development stuff, basically what I think what we've been considering, upstream costs, upstream development costs, or is there partial midstream or delivery costs in there? What all
Representative
what
Newman,
are we talking about?
Yeah. Representative Newman, we're talking about both, what you've just characterized. There's, in terms of arriving at what the dollar amount is that we will apply the production tax to, we take into account the downstream cost, which are your tanker costs and your pipeline costs. We also take into account the upstream costs, which are the cost all the way from the ground out to the pipeline, and those are called lease expenditure costs. And you arrive at what's left over after you take into account all of those costs, and that's the dollar figure against which we apply our tax rate. That's for the basic production tax liability. What sometimes gets confusing is then, for instance, for purposes of this tax credit, we may go back and look at some of those same categories of expenditures, and in an effort to incentivize or encourage that type of activity, we may give it a boost and give someone a credit for a certain percentage of those costs that they get to now apply against their tax bill. So you might have a certain cost that gets counted both in arriving at that next net amount and also then gets used to create a credit.
And we do have an amendment on the floor, and I would like to speak to that. And are you, as long as you're addressing the amendment, I want to stay on that.
I am.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because it was referred to as a process tax, I'm just trying to get some clarification on that. And so, so you've got credits that are applied, you've got all your deductions that are accounted for production, development, midstream, a combination of all those expenditures. And then because we're in this bill, we're offering the opportunity for exploration credits, mm-hmm. or an expansion of exploration credits to create some jobs in Alaska. Then if we, and I just I have trouble trying to refer to that as a profits tax, and I guess that they're basically, it's not a, I mean, you've got your profits, or I guess that's the you got all your expenditures and what you sell your product for. You know, I guess that could be considered your profit. And then, so is this a tax against those profits or a credit that you can use against additional taxes that you may pay?
Chairman Newman, what you said in the latter category is precisely correct. It's a credit that you would apply against the taxes that you might owe. So that's what this particular provision is.
So it's a credit on additional taxes that you would pay in that you've made.
It's a credit against the taxes you otherwise would owe. Correct.
That's what I was trying to get to. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions? Representative Kawasaki, is your objection to the sunset date still withheld?
It's not a sunset date.
I mean, I'm sorry, effective date.
I'm
back on the trails.
Yeah. Old stream. Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. I think I still maintain my objection. You know, we're getting this effective date is much different than the calendar year dates of taxation. There's some date in here, retroactivity back to February 28th. 2007. There's an effective date 90 days after this bill goes into law. I think that this confuses the situation for revenue, and I know that they're being nice by saying that they probably handle the changes, and they have in the past, but it's a difficult challenge when there's so many things at stake. I also, you know, just a comment that if this bill becomes law, we add this incurred at June 30th, 2010, I wonder if there might be some producers or explorers out there that decide to wait until that point in time. I think we want to see producers and explorers go out in the field as soon as possible, and I don't want them to try and wait in order to just take advantage of this credit. And so I think that I don't think that this credit or this date does what we'd like it to do, and that's spur more development.
Representative Kawasaki, would you like to amend that to say May 30th of 2010?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
if the goal is to speed it up, I'm all for it.
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, I think my other objection is that the department would not be able to comply with this particular provision. And I think we want them to get it right. I think that you understand that I'm have a general objection to this bill. I don't know how much better we can try to make this at all. So I'll maintain my objection.
Yep. Dan, are you online? Dan Dickinson?
I am, Mr. Chairman.
Do you have anything to add to this effective date argument?
No, Mr. Chairman. I mean,
okay.
I think the arguments have been summed up clearly. What you would like is to have this happen on the first of a month rather than the day the bill becomes effective, which could be in the middle of a month, and then you spend a lot of time arguing about, you know, whether it's when the check cleared and when something was actually paid for. So the rules are clearest if you're over a division of a year. As Marcia noted, the department has already put in rules to deal with what happens when you have it occurring on the first of the month. And I would just add the observation, if you look at the other due dates, the other effective dates in here, as Representative Kawasaki noted, there's a wide range. And again, it's interest is calculated on a quarterly basis, therefore it's on the first day of the quarter where the provisions affect interest. Progressivity is calculated on a monthly basis, so where the provision affects progressivity, it becomes due on the first day of the month. And that's the reason for this variety of different due dates.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with a due date having an effective date, you know, after we pass the bill. However, I just want to make sure that if we pass this amendment, we're not going to be prohibited from discussing how the bill would have affected the resources, the revenue we received from previous from the previous years since ACES started. I think that we have some information that's been presented going back to 2008 and what those the effects would be. So as long as we're under the assumption that we can discuss what the effect would have been had this provision been in effect, I have no problem with the effectiveness.
Representative Seaton, I don't intend to limit debate on this bill in any way. I want to get everything on the table. I do want to get it out today or tomorrow, but or not, depending on how the committee votes. But that's the only stipulation that I have, and I want to have discussions and continue to have discussions. Representative Kawasaki, do you maintain your objection?
Yes.
Would the clerk please call the roll? Amendment number 2, so that everyone knows, is the effective date June 30th, 2010.
Yes vote accepts amendment.
A yes vote accepts amendment. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Seaton?
Excuse me.
Representative Guttenberg.
So without the effective date in here, the effective date is when the bill is goes into effect as it is.
90 days after the governor signs it, which could be the first through the something of any month, depending on when he signs it.
Thank you.
If he signs it. Thank you for that clarification. Madam Clerk?
Okay, so the vote is on Amendment 2. Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Co-Chair Newman?
Yes.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Yes.
8 yay, 1 nay.
Amendment number 2 has passed. That brings before us amendment number 3, and I would move amendment number 3.
Object.
We do have an objection.
Mr. Chairman, which one is 3?
I'm sorry. Amendment number 3 is P.3.
Thank you.
26LS1328, P.3. And I may have put those in a different order, but we were the same way they numbered them. What amendment number 2 does, and I'll speak to the amendment, and then you can speak to your objection, it defines well-related expenditures, and this adopts the same language that we basically adopted in the previous bill on gas storage to clarify and for consistency. Basically, Marcia, if you'd like to speak to this, and I think you worked with Mr. Dickinson on this so we'd be clarified on the same page. So if you'd speak to that, I'd appreciate it.
Right. And I probably should defer to Dan because he's
okay,
the primary architect.
Okay, then we can go with Dan. Mr. Dickinson, are you online?
I am.
Would you speak to amendment number 3, which is P.3, which is the definition of well-related expenditures?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you said, this is based on the definition that was in House Bill 280. There are some changes between that bill and this one. But the basic idea, and I think I'll throw back into Marcia's lap breath if she wants to clarify this a little bit, but the basic idea was to try to draw a bright line. Rather than having a general definition that says well-related expenditures and the department goes out and gets public testimony and tries to craft the definition, what we have here is, I think, a fairly bright line that's in federal tax law. And that line is something called intangible drilling and development costs. So basically, if it qualifies as an intangible drilling and development cost, then during exploration and during development, it will be considered a well-related expense. There are some examples of that in here: well sidetracking, well deepening, well completion, recompletion, well workover, the kinds of activities I think this bill is trying to encourage. And those would all be, you know, you would go and look at the federal tax return. Might have to wait a couple of years. Sometimes those are a year too late. But generally, producers, taxpayers understand what's going to be in there. And if it's going to be on their federal tax return, they'll take it as part of the credit. And the state can always go back and check some years later. The second piece of the definition here, which is a Romanet 2, says during production, what we're going to look at for the least expenditure are those things that are designed to enhance productivity, to get more out of the well, to mitigate the decline. And generally, that's going to be the kind of work that you do to get more oil to the operations. But the line that it draws is the once the well fluids hit the surface, hit the so-called Christmas tree, and they move into processing facilities, those are not considered part of this credit. So typically, some of the work you might do to get more production out of a well would be you'd go downstream and you'd say, well, I can't get any more well fluids because I've got so much water that I'm handling here, so I'm going to de-bottleneck my water processing. And no, those kind of costs would not be included. So A deals with sort of the very broad definition of what are costs, and I think it draws bright lines. I think, as Marcia said, the department would write regulations, but I think in general, this credit could be effective immediately in the sense that producers would have a very good sense of what was going to be in and what was out because they know what the federal tax rule is. The next piece on this is B, on the second page, Mr. Chairman, and basically it just clarifies that seismic work that's undertaken within a unit is included. Now, generally, if you're doing seismic work within a unit, it's well-related. Typically, if you're out doing seismic work out, you know, in rank exploration, and you're out in some place that hasn't been drilled, you're trying to see whether you're going to drill or not. I think the seismic work that's done in a unit, you're trying to figure out where to drill, or even why you're drilling, where to sidetrack. There are some amazing things happening in sort of horizontal drilling, and you're trying to figure out exactly the lay of the land that you're drilling through. So this just complements the provisions that are in the exploration credits, the 025 credits, and those say any seismic work conducted outside the boundaries of a production or exploration unit gets a credit. This gives a credit for the work inside those units. And finally, Mr. Chairman, all C does is fit this into the same category as the way other things are handled, and it says, you know, indirect costs aren't allowed, or the overheads aren't allowed, But instead, once you know what your direct costs are, then there is a markup on that, and the size of that markup was left to the department's determination. And in 165A2, Marsha, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I believe it is now at 4.5%. So once you figure out what your direct costs are, all the indirect costs that instead of fighting about whether some support piece was part of this or not, you just simply take your direct costs and multiply by 4.5%. So, Mr. Chairman, those are the pieces of this amendment. And I think if you look at this is about three times as long as the existing language in the bill that's before you, but I think this will, as Marsha said, give people direction and make a lot clearer what the legislature had in mind.
Thank you, Dan. And just for clarification, this is the well workover section that the governor has in his piece of legislation, and so I want to make sure that the administration is comfortable with this definition as you can be, and that you work with the sponsor to make sure that this fits and makes everything work out. Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Marsha. The definition, is this well-related expenditures on new wells, existing wells, and for, I guess, overworked wells, is that the term? Worked over wells. So it applies to all three then?
Representative Kawasaki, yes, it would. And the intent here was to essentially capture sort of the phases of a life in creating and operating a well. So under this capture, you're focusing on the exploration and the development phase of locating, drilling the well, and then in part two, Romanet two, it's the production of the well. But what is covered under the various categories is going to be different. And, you know, based on the governor's bill, governor certainly was very focused on making sure that we were adding a category for what are called infill drilling, which are the post-drilling types of activities. And the problem was that because the current drill credit in the exploration section required you to be so many miles outside of existing units, they couldn't qualify there. They could qualify for the 20% capital credit under 023. But in terms of creating an enhanced credit for that type of infill work, this does a similar thing to what the governor's bill does. It goes a little broader, but it's similar.
I guess.
Representative Kawasaki, follow-up?
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, can you tell me the purpose or the reason why you wouldn't want to give credits infill and you'd want those credits to be applied outside of the field, I guess, so you can find more of what the basin looks like? I mean, is that part of the application of that?
Well, in terms of how it was originally structured, mm-hmm. Representative Kawasaki, I think as originally structured, when ACES was originally passed, there was a focus that the 20% credit would be adequate for the things that happened within the unit, mm-hmm. and that the enhanced credit for exploration was necessary because it was very risky. In the years since the passage of ACES, I think one of the things that folks have through both the legislative body's investigation as well as, you know, listening to what's going on in the field, certainly the, say, Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik are the bulk or the lion's share of our production and our revenue stream. And to the extent that costs incurred by operators within those fields may require some more extraordinary costs or extraordinary efforts to continue the productivity of a declining field, the question became, why would you not incentivize some of those infield type drilling activities as well? And so the sense was to try to put on parity some of the exploration activity with some of the infield because they had the same, if not, you know, more enhanced immediate effect on production.
Representative Kawasaki.
The part B on this number three, seismic work conducted within the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, maybe I read that wrong.
You're talking about page two of the amendment?
Yeah, page two of the amendment, Mr. Chairman. So maybe I heard it wrong. I thought I heard that seismic work conducted outside of the boundaries could be used to apply to the credit on the field. That's kind of what I thought I heard, but I'm reading it now and it doesn't seem that way. It was actually what
And I think what he was referencing is outside the field, seismic work outside the field is different than seismic work inside the field. I think he referenced it. It's for a different purpose.
Okay.
This one's to enhance and the other one's to find, I think is, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think that's what I heard him say.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you. And that was Dan Dickinson.
The 5 credit would cover exploration costs, hence costs that where you were outside of a unit looking for places perhaps where you could drill.
Okay.
Representative Gunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll start off with a question on that same point on B, page 2, the seismic work. What well would the seismic work be enhancing? A specific well or specific groups of wells not drilled yet, wells that might be drilled on other pads because of they redefine the field? How would that relate to what it is that's there?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, it's my understanding as far as seismic work, that's oftentimes used in association with some of the recompletions where essentially they want to be more precise in locating where you may be within an existing wellbore. You may want to use seismic to help redirect and guide your choice in terms of where you're going to do another lateral completion out from the bottom of the wellbore. Seismic presumably could also be used for fields where you're already within a producing unit, but it's a fractured unit, so there are lenses, and I believe it's the position of the DNR that oftentimes that production is considered contiguous and is part of the same unit. So it might inform those kinds of choices where you're trying to target smaller pockets that have been isolated from the main or partially isolated from the main reservoir.
Representative Gunberg, follow up?
I can follow up.
Our new question
is just focusing perhaps the definition of seismic. I mean, seismic could be 2D, 3D. It could be by explosives, or it could be by vibrator, or it could be probably things I don't even know about. Do we have a definition of what seismic is?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, I don't believe we do in the tax code. And I think what we've done here, at least during the exploration phase, the only type of cost that'll be eligible for this credit are going to be if they qualify under the IRS code definition for an intangible drilling cost. In the context of a production seismic activity, then it's going to have to meet these criteria. And, frankly, I don't think production is really going to apply in this piece because you're really talking about existing production. Development in the way this is written would involve more likely the situations I was just describing, where you have an existing field and you're continuing to develop and access new parts of the existing reservoir or new reservoirs. So I think what's going to happen here is the seismic is going to be tied to the exploration and development phase.
Representative Gunberg, follow up. Continuation.
Thank you. In statute now, are we dealing with well-related expenditures in any way, or this is the first time we're opening up well-related work?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, this is a new term of art. And what we have is for our current 023 credits, we use the term qualified capital expenditure as our term of art, and our regulations have defined that, and statute defines it. Under our 025 credit, which is our existing exploration style, the statute defines categories of costs that are allowed to receive that credit, and they include both some capital and some operating type expenses, but it's a category of expenses that is different than this one. So this credit will create a new category of expenses.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you for the leeway, Mr. Chair. So under I on the first page, or 3AI, we're talking about intangible drilling and development costs as recognized under the IRS code. Is that specifically for exploration development costs? Are there other definitions under the IRS code, or are there other definitions outside of the IRS code that we might want to consider?
In terms of what this is selected, you first start out with the universe of what will be allowed as a lease expenditure, and then a subset of the lease expenditures allowed here is going to be only those things that would qualify as an intangible drilling and development cost. And It's my understanding, and Dan, you can correct me, that that's a pretty circumscribed set of cost items, and it's got a fairly large body of law worked up around it to sort of make it clear what those costs are.
Dan, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, I mean, there might be other definitions. I'm not aware of them. I mean, I'm sure there are other definitions of what well-related costs are, but I think, as Marcia made the point, is this is a tax definition, so there are a whole bunch of court cases that sort of clearly set the boundaries, and they've been thought of in a tax context. And so in that sense, it makes sense to go to this set of pre-existing definitions.
One more question.
And I think, I mean, to answer the I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. One more question, if I may.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. So in Section I, 3AI, at the bottom of the page, we're excluding processing, gathering, separating, and processing well fluids downstream. Have we left anything out that we're not including in this that we could give a deduction for?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, this particular subset of lease expenditures that will be allowed during production are pretty narrowly circumscribed here by virtue of having to be related to the processes of operating the well and moving fluids to this particular assembly, the wellhead itself down. By virtue of including this exclusion, saying, but it doesn't include the processes of gathering, separating, and processing fluids downstream from that assembly, we've sort of drawn a line in the sand at that the wellhead assembly, saying costs that are incurred upstream of that, we're not going to take into account the costs that are downstream of that, that affect the items of equipment downstream, are included. So yes, absolutely, there are things that are upstream of that the body could consider, but this is a fairly clear line in the sand.
One more question on that point.
Promise?
Yes. Unless you bring something up.
So
I know in the past when we've defined things that leave one facility and go to another, and I know a wellhead or a Christmas tree is that might have a well house on top of it. How do we define downstream? Is it immediately when it's off the pad? Is it when it goes to or hits another facility? What is downstream?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, I think the language here, by talking about the assembly of valves, pipes, and fittings used to control the flow of gas from the casing head, sort of defines what we're going to call the assembly. So when it says that assembly, I'm assuming it's referring to the described assembly in the two lines above.
Okay.
So I think it's going to be interpreted by our tax specialist reading the statutory language is very literally. It'll be stopping at wherever the valves, pipes, and fittings stop that control the flow.
Representative Gutenberg,
thank you.
And what we wanted to do, and I think in response to Representative Seaton's questions before about what was going to be included, how far down the road would we go, it was the intention to stop once it got above ground.
Okay.
I think what we've tried to do here is define that as tightly and narrowly as we can. And I think we've accomplished that. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Representative Wilson, I apologize.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcia, under Roman numeric number one, that includes, and it says, well sidetracking, well deepening, well completion or recompletion, and well workover, and does not include disposal wells. Are all kinds of wells listed here, or are there others?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, you could conceivably have an injector well. I don't see injector well literally listed, but it would, it should fit within this description.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I think that one law.
Would you identify yourself, Dan?
Specifically include injection wells.
It does say that.
One point of difference between
right.
the governor's bill and this, in that the governor's bill excluded what were called service wells.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go and look in the AOGCC regs, you would see that service wells include injectors. So this is, I think as Marcia said, there were some differences between this and the governor's definitions. This is a little bit broader, and it includes injection wells. And again, one of the issues as we looked at this is how do you minimize conflicts and you draw clean lines. There are wells that get drilled, get used for production, and then when that area has been thoroughly, maybe it's been clogged up or it's not getting as much production as you would like, you then turn that well into an injection well. Other wells are specifically drilled as injection wells. But rather than get into a sort of an issue of if it started out as life as one thing and finished life as another, made clear that it would be included here as an injection well would be allowed.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Seaton.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcia, what is the definition between or the discrimination between an injection well and a disposal well?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. A disposal well is a type of injection well. Essentially, it's just a question of what substance are you injecting. In terms of injector wells that enhance or intended to enhance or drive production, you can have water injection, miscible injection type wells. You can also have injectors that are essentially disposing of drill cuttings and mud, et cetera, which are designed to go to a place in the underground that won't impact or harm your production. You might have water disposal wells. So in terms of disposal, an injector in this case, we basically does not include disposal wells. Disposal would be the sense that you are getting rid of something that does not have a useful purpose. It's not being disposed of for a design to enhance production or anything.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if you're disposing of CO2, if you're disposing of water, if you're disposing of natural gas, if you're recycling natural gas, all of those would be injection wells under this terminology, and the only thing that wouldn't be a injection well would be mud or chips or something that was not going to in some way pressurize the field.
Again, if as long as there is some production enhancing aspect to the injection that you're basically injecting to impact the producing part of the reservoir, then we would consider that an injector well that would be allowed. I could imagine in some world where CO2 might be injected but for purposes of disposal as opposed to coming into contact and being used for pressure support or something. So, it depends on the purpose for the injection that would define whether you're disposing it or not. What is your intent in getting rid of the material you have?
Representative Seaton.
And following up on that, that's just at the producers. If they say we're disposing of the CO2 to pressurize the field, there's neither you nor DNR have the ability to really go in and say, well, the reason you're doing that for isn't adequate, or that we think you're getting rid of that CO2 instead of adequately using it. I mean, are we just
Representative Seaton, I think it's very clear whether or not the injector, depending upon where the bottom hole location is relative to the reservoir, you're going to be able to tell whether there is or is not pressure support purposes.
Yeah. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And under 2I, the 2I on 17 and on, we have on line 18 for maintaining and 20 operating a well and moving fluid. So we're really just talking about the operation, the normal operation of a field, we're giving a tax credit for operating everything below the surface of, since most of our money comes from Prudhoe and Kuparuk, from some of the most profitable fields and the largest fields in North America, we're going to give this, under the terminology here, we're going to give this tax credit for operating the field, anything below ground. Is that what I'm understanding?
Representative Seaton, I think there's a more nuanced approach to this, because again, this is the part of the definition that was included in House Bill 280 in nod to the governor's concern that a credit be given to get something. And in this case, once you've gone beyond exploration development, you're just talking about day-to-day, what is it that this credit would deliver that you otherwise wouldn't have? And essentially, the life cycle of every well is going to be, once you get through your flush production, it's going to be decline. And the question is, a producer can incur costs to slow that decline and try to maintain a production level that they had before, which means it's flat, or stem the decline so that, but for doing the activity, they would have less production than they otherwise are going to have. So the design here is not to give a credit to someone who is just basically turnkeying, saying, going in and saying, I'll send a guy out to, you know, tinker with the wellhead, but do nothing to stem the normal decline of that well production. Rather, this is designed to target those activities that producers do to try to pump up and improve the production rate that would otherwise happen if they simply just let it go.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, Marsha gave a very good explanation.
That's Dan Dickinson. If you'd identify yourself when you talk, Dan.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Dan Dickinson.
Thank you.
For working for LB&A, and whenever I give a presentation, I always put up the slide that shows the amount of decline and what's happening in it. And people can very, I think, quickly see the exact point that Marsha was making, which is that if you maintain, instead of having a 6 or 7% decline every year, you would have a flat line, and that's the use of the word maintain here, and or that's what it's certainly intended to be.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Dickinson. I'm trying to figure out then, if you are pumping fluids out of a well, if you're operating a well and moving fluids and maintaining production, you know, we've got almost every field on the North Slope, including, of course, the two biggest ones, are where we're talking about infield, are in decline. So is there any time that you would say that you're operating and pulling oil out of ground that you're not attempting to maintain operating that well and fluid, and is that something that you can go in and say, well, gee, you didn't slow it to 3% decline, therefore none of these credits count? Or is it from a projected, well, if we did absolutely nothing, we would have a 12% decline, so as long as we're less than 12% decline, we are maintaining production, and therefore these credits apply?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I think your earlier statement is absolutely correct, and it is to avoid just those kinds of disputes so auditors aren't sitting with oil companies and saying, well, you could have done this or you should have done this, and this is the relative rate of decline. Instead, we've tried to create a rule that says anytime you're investing money, you're spending new money to get oil out of the ground, the below ground portion of that is going to be included. And so I think your earlier statement, that's correct, that's the way the rule has been framed, is exactly correct. And then if you go to the North Slope to, you know, go to Prudhoe Bay, and you have the central gas facility, and you have the central compression plant, and you have the flow stations, and you have six, you know, flow stations and gathering centers, those costs are the ones that are excluded from this. And that's the way that the line has been drawn to specifically aim for the quote, the well costs.
Dan or Marsha, who can answer this, do you ever know of an oil company that spent money to keep the same production level? Or to keep it from, to keep the same decline?
Yeah, to keep the same production level, Mr. Chairman. There was no decline after 99. A lot of money was spent to simply not decline further. When you're hitting the maximum of your capacities or something, you're there. But generally, the reason you invest is to get oil out. And if that investment doesn't get more production, you're not going to make the investment.
And I think that was my at least that's the hope, to get more production. Any other questions? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, looking at the amendment, we have well completion or recompletion. Is that different from a well workover, recompletion? What is recompletion?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I'm not the, I'm probably not the right expert here, but I'll tell you what I understand it to be. A recompletion oftentimes is where you've drilled a well and you've gotten to your targeted zone, and you may think that you're getting suboptimal performance, and so you may choose to recomplete the well at a deeper level, at a higher level, but you're essentially re-entering a well bore that has now been drilled to its intended location. And so you're going to be turning it into essentially a different type of a well. a well at a slightly different location or a different depth.
Follow-up, Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then when we talk about regardless on line 13 of page 1, a well workover, regardless as to whether the well is or has been a producing well. So when would we want to do a well workover if it's a, if it's not a producing well or never had been a producing well? I guess it's just hoping that it would be a producing well?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I think that that statement there is a well workover, whether it is currently a producing well or whether it had been and was now shut in or suspended and they were going back in to do a well workover. So it presumes that it was a well that was drilled at one time and had been producing, and whether it had stopped producing or not, it was intended to cover well workover costs.
Okay, and
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But there could have been a well that was shut down that had not been producing. The tax credits would go to opening that back up and looking further, and maybe even doing a recompletion, drilling down further on that. That's what that's referring to.
Yes.
Okay, and one more, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
The stratigraphic test wells. Can you define that for me? I'm sorry, I don't know that term.
It's defined in various locations. I think we've got a definition in the 025 section. But it's essentially a well that's drilled solely for the purpose of ascertaining data information. So it's a measuring or a data type well. The challenge that we have is, and I did speak with Kathy Forrester at the AOGCC about this, is that that kind of a well can qualify as an IDC type costed well if it is capable of transporting hydrocarbon fluids, if it were to encounter hydrocarbons. And when I talked to Kathy, she said that occasionally someone will drill a stratigraphic well to gain data and information, and it costs money to drill the well, so they might not make it the full big bore well pipe, but they might make smaller pipe to save money. But if they get to a producing oil and gas horizon, they may make the choice to go ahead and produce from that well if it's not a huge gangbuster, you know, such that it'd be better to go ahead and just throw that one away and come in and drill a big well. And so it is possible that you could have a stratigraphic test well that not only yields data but also could be a producer.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can a stratigraphic test well end up becoming a disposal well?
It could. It could. It probably not likely, because most disposal wells are designed for the product that's being disposed of. Oftentimes, the casing that you use, the size casing, usually has to be fairly large to deal with the stuff you're doing. And likewise, where the well is going to generally has to be carefully selected, because it has to be approved by all the different environmental organizations. So you have to demonstrate you're drilling to a location that cannot access, say, drinking water or be susceptible of leaking out or being uncontrolled. So it would be an incredibly rare occurrence for that to happen.
Okay. And then, Mr.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so is disposal well the only thing that is an exception to any type of exploration and development that we're speaking of? I mean, is that the only exception, or what other exceptions are there? And during exploration and development,
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I can't think of anything that would be well related. That, as long as it fits within the definition of being a lease expenditure and meets the criteria of being an intangible drilling and development cost, that should pretty much just be excluding disposal wells. Dan, I could defer to you if you can think of any other types of well operations.
Representative Tuck, through the chair. No, I think that summarizes the kinds of wells. And there are some wells that you would use a different credit for. For example, there is a 40% exploration credit for wildcat frontier type exploration. In other words, if you're more than 25 miles from an existing unit or 5 miles from any other drilling that's been done. So those wells would show up in a different section of the statute. But if for some reason you didn't qualify, or let's say 30 years earlier, you know, somebody was drilling 2 miles away or something, then this would be the pertinent place where the credit would go.
Yes. Thank you. Before we go any further, this is the same language we adopted a week ago, defining wells. This is a conforming amendment, and what I'd like to do is either decide whether we want to have a conforming language in the bill or not. So I'd like to move ahead and move this amendment or not. We can keep separate language for separate fields, but I'd rather have consistent language for the regulators. So what I'd like to do is wrap this debate up. It's the same debate we had last week on Representative Hawker's bill on storage. So what I want to do is wrap this up, and we can make a determination whether we want consistent language or not. That's the basic call on what this amendment does. Representative Seaton, in wrap-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had two questions, one on B and C. One, on our 025 exploration credits on the North Slope, do we get the data?
Representative Seaton, under 025, yes, we do.
And under this provision, do we get the data?
I don't believe there's language.
If I, not in this definition, but if you look in the in what is amending, so if you look on page 9, which is where this amendment would go, this is section 3, and if you look up right above it, lines 19 through 23, you will see that's where the producer has to agree in writing to the terms where it turns it over to it, and then B says not only have they agreed to do it, but they've actually done it. So yes, all the terms that apply to the exploration data will apply to anything that is done here.
Thank you. And the second question I had was, I know that we have some ability of deductibility or deductions of an amount of overhead. Do we have any other places where we give credit for overhead in any of the other sections?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, no, this would be the only credit I'm aware of that would have an allowance for overhead.
Thank you. With the question, is your objection still maintained, Representative Kawasaki?
Yep.
Would the Representative Wilson, before we vote?
Yes, just one thing. Marsha, do they get a deduction for overhead anywhere else?
Representative Wilson, through their chair, yes. As I was describing for Co-Chairman Newman, when we take the amount of sales price and strip out the transportation cost, when we go and deduct lease expenditures, one of the elements of lease expenditures is overhead. So they recover the 4.5% of all of their direct costs as their overhead, and that gets deducted before we come up with the net remaining amount, what's called the production tax value, against which we apply the tax.
So essentially, we're going to give them. Well,
if I might just add one thing to Marsha's answer, which was absolutely.
Would be Dan Dickinson.
And that is, if HB 280 becomes law, then there will be a deduction there as well. In other words, that this is, as the chairman said, this is conforming language. The application is just is slightly different, but generally that would be a place in law where you would have it. But Marsha's right. Right now there is not.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you. So we're allowing them to deduct it twice?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, on this...
Yes or no?
On this particular... yes, we would, but it overhead as well as the underlying cost, because all of those, like overhead, get deducted against as lease expenditures to arrive at the net amount. And then that's the beauty of credits. You're going in and giving them a double bang for their buck kind of thing. Yeah. So it's an extra carry for those costs.
Additional questions?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, just the most basic question of them all. Does the department support this?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, we certainly support the concept of having a credit for, as similar to what the governor had in his bill for infill drilling type expenditures. You know, this isn't our bill, but it's got a lot of elements that are similar to our bill.
Follow-up?
I'm not sure what
She's very good.
Representative Edgman.
I was just thinking in terms of the artful responses from departments, that
was good.
No, I don't mean that wit that came off sounding, but let me put it to you this way then. This language is written differently than obviously the governor's language is written. Mm-hmm. So is this language more aggressive than the department, than the governor would desire?
Certainly, I think there's a few places where it's gone farther than the governor's bill has gone. And I think as far as having a credit for that type of activity, the governor is supportive. I think, speaking just to this amendment, I think the governor could live with this type of a credit, not speaking to the other parts of the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, Representative Kawasaki, you maintain your objection?
Yes, I do.
Would you please call the roll, Madam Clerk?
Yes being adopting Amendment Number 3, no being rejection.
Okay, roll call on Amendment 3. Representative Edmund?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg?
No.
Representative Kawasaki?
No.
Representative Tuck?
No.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
No.
Co-Chair Newman?
Yes.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Yes.
Amendment yay, 4 nay.
Amendment number 3 has passed. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move amendment number 4, which would be P4.
And I'll object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hang on a second, Representative Seaton. Can we take a brief recess? Not a recess. Just keep your seat. Stay where you are. Eddie. Let's go back on the record. We have before us amendment number 4. It has been moved and objected to. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move and...
We've moved it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment to amendment number 4. Distributed on you.
I had that before. I know I did.
Okay.
I'm going to object.
There is an objection, Representative Seaton. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, in the legal process, you know how things go sometimes.
I do.
What this is we consolidated the original amendment, which was delineating by field, and there were several portions here, so that it was by taxpayer producing over 100,000 BTU equivalent barrels of oil and gas per day. And these sections in the conceptual amendment didn't get changed to the tax liability instead of the field and reservoir portion. So if you would just look at that on line, page 1, line 8, it's taking out just the within the unit or the field, because we're talking about a taxpayer now instead of a taxpayer's production from a field or unit, and that's the same throughout here. So we are just eliminating those and putting in a producer's total tax liability instead of talking about tax bill liability from a unit or non-unitized reservoir. Okay.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, question for Ms. Davis while we got her. Marcia, if we talk about the gross value of oil and gas, is right now, if oil is selling in the market for $78.43, it was today, or $80, or $4.02, or $4 for gas, is that, could you consider that the gross value of that gas?
Chairman Newman, no, the gross value is considered, it because there's a term of art, it's called the gross value at the point of production. So you would take the numbers you've just cited, say a West Coast price of $80, and you would deduct the marine and the pipeline costs up to, say, the North Slope, where the point of production begins at pump
wellhead.
Station 1. Wellhead. Well, it's a little different than wellhead, but it's at the pump station.
Pump station 1.
But goes into
where it goes through the meter.
Right. So you just deduct the transportation cost from that $80 and arrive at what is considered the gross value of the point of production.
If I may, Mr.
Representative.
If
is this to the amendment to the amendment?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Just want to make sure.
So if the value of oil was $80 West Coast, approximately what would be the value at the meter at pump station 1, the gross value?
We use roughly $6.5-$7 for the transportation cost.
So
that would
$80
be
roughly oil, $73.
$73, correct.
Okay. That's what I thought.
And then,
thank you. And then gas right now is $4.02, and I guess we haven't got that far on cost and stuff like that, but if they make 2 cents, they're going to be lucky by the time they're done after they get to their gross value. So we'll just work on the oil end of it at $73. So, and then a couple more follow-ups.
Representative Newman, go ahead.
I just need to make sure I'm clear on what I'm talking about here. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we talk about, and this is in the amendment, but there's amendments to the amendment, so it's applicable. So when we talk about BTU equivalents, what is the BTU equivalent for a standard cubic foot?
Representative Newman, let's. Okay. I'm confused that we're talking about the amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
I would like to go ahead and accept the amendment to the amendment with everyone's permission, and then talk about the amendment as a whole. I think that'd be a lot simpler than trying to deal with it individually. And I think I know where you're going, but I think you kind of, if we could go ahead and accept it or reject it either way, and Representative Wilson.
And I apologize. I wasn't here when he explained the amendment to the amendment. So if he could just
go over it one more time, yeah. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, as the amendment had been previously laid on the table at our previous meeting, it was talking about reservoirs, and when Leg Legal redrafted it, so we were talking about taxpayer liability, single company taxpayer liability, because that's the way the tax is now calculated, they didn't take out a couple of references to reservoirs and units. So all this amendment, the amendment does is take it back to, we're talking about the taxpayer and the taxpayer's liability, not oil and gas produced from a certain reservoir. And so this is the way the taxes are calculated, and this just is really conforming to make sure that we're talking about the taxpayer's liability, not specifically from a unit or a reservoir.
And this is a conceptual amendment, number one to number four. And with that, I withdraw my amendment, but in no way does that indicate any support for the pending amendment. Is there any additional, Representative Tuck?
Yeah, can I object just to ask one quick question?
Sure.
Okay, amendment to the amendment is because there could be more than one single taxpayer on a single reservoir. And it's just clarifying that it would be the single taxpayer and not all for the whole reservoir.
Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, it's because we are talking about a taxpayer that produces over 100,000 barrels in their total production. It's not related to a single unit or to a single field. It's their tax base, and that's where they're taxed, is they're taxed on their entire production.
So, and I do believe that Representative Newman objected to the amendment to the amendment. Representative Newman, do you still object? I'd ask you to withdraw that so that we can move on to the amendment.
I will withdraw my objection to the amendment, conceptual amendment to number four, if you maintain your objection to number four.
I maintain my objection to the full amendment, but not
thank
to
you. I withdraw my objection to the
conceptual amendment. Okay, are there any other objections to the conceptual amendment number one to amendment number four? Seeing none, conceptual amendment to amendment number four has, conceptual amendment number one to amendment number four has passed. Now we have before us amendment number four, and I have objected and will maintain the objection. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Industry has come forward and asked for getting more of the upside, in other words, reducing progressivity or reducing the way we tax so that we would tax them less on the upside. And when we originally established ACES, we were looking at a balance. We had a floor mechanism. In fact, the earlier version of this was exactly out of that. We negotiated, we worked, and we said, we'll take the risk of on the downside so that if you're not making money, you don't have to pay, but we're going to take more money on the upside. Now what we're doing is we're coming back and saying, well, we're going to recalculate the taxes and credits so that you get more of the upside, and if to restore that balance, then what this does is put back in the floor amendment on the gross so that we maintain some tax at the lower at lower prices. So this is exactly where we are trying to renew our balance in the tax system so that if industry wants more of the upside, then the balance is that we get some protection on the downside.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Before we go on, Marcia, have you had a chance to review this amendment at all? Dan, have you had a chance to review this amendment? Do you have it before you? And
Chance.
Okay. Well, I'm not asking for anything yet. I just want to make sure that you have it in front of you. We will be to you. So with that, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Davis, or I think you can answer this one. What is the standard, what is the BTU equivalent of a standard cubic feet of methane?
Well, if you're getting at the conversion factors, because we basically move from the amount of gas it takes to create 6,000 BTUs of energy is what we call one barrel equivalent. And as I recall from some earlier testimony by, I can't remember who it was, but it's not exactly one, and it depends on which field's gas you're talking about. Roughly, people generally try to talk about it as a one-for-one. It's not exact, though.
So
Representative Newman.
That's like for oil, but about 6,000 BTUs per cubic foot mm-hmm. of methane.
I'll refer to Dan. I'm terrible with those conversions. I really am, so I don't want to miss
what I'm trying to get at here, Marsh, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
You know, when we talk about it, it says more than 100,000, Representative Seaton had mentioned earlier, barrels of oil, but it's 100,000 BTU equivalent barrels of oil in the amendment, and of oil and gas. And when we talk about, you know, gas or the methane that we're talking right now, where we've got methane, I believe, is around 6,000 a standard cubic foot, and
per barrel, per
cubic foot. Okay. So, I mean, if you could get 14 cubic foot, you'd up to be up to 100,000 BTU equivalent. Mm-hmm. So, at 14 cubic foot of methane. But then, you know, but and I guess where you get into the gases and BTU equivalent, I think where it's so critical, and it goes back to a question that we had earlier on Representative Johnson's amendment, is because we're using propanes and other NGLs for miscible gases to help assist in lifting the heavy oils out that are mixed in the oil that goes down taps. And those are at a declining rate of being able to use them because taps is declining, and they'll become volatile in the pipe and blow a pump station up probably by 2013, 2014, somewhere in there, so which will bring the value of our oil down considerably because it'll be less, it won't be as an enriched blend and have less BTU value. And because of those gases, or the propane, if they're, you know, propane has a BTU value of 2.5 times more than methane. So different gases are at different rates, and so we, I guess the bottom line of what I'm saying is 100,000 BTU equivalent of gas could be as little as 10 or 14 cubic feet of gas.
Representative Newman, through the chair, I think what's being used here when they use the term BTU equivalent barrels of oil and gas, they're referring back to the definitional section and not taking the BTU in isolation, but rather they're talking about it as a term of art, which is a BTU equivalent barrel, and that's in gas. It's always going to be the amount of gas that has a heating value of 6 million BTUs. So it tries to equilibrate what you're talking about, which is differences between propane or NGLs or LNGs.
The short line on this is this is just about all oil and gas produced at north of 68 degrees.
Representative Newman, through the chair, it certainly applies to every bit of oil and gas. It only applies to North Slope, as I read it, and it only applies to a taxpayer who themselves, on any average day of a year, has credited to their account production of at least 100,000 barrels of oil equivalent. So whether it's all oil or whether it's a mixture of oil and gas or whether it's all gas, it's intended to only, this minimum tax would only apply to those specific taxpayers.
Which is just about all producers, everything north of 68, or all wells that are producing it. Most of them.
Well, Representative Newman, through the chair, again, it's only that specific taxpayer. So you might have a small owner, you know, Exxon's share of Exxon of part production is relatively small and wouldn't meet that criteria. But, you know, you'd have to add up all of their interests at Kuparik and Prudhoe and Point Thompson and Endicott and ask, are they averaging 100,000 barrels of oil equivalent a day? And then that would tell you whether that particular taxpayer is going to be subject to this minimum tax. So I think the intent, as I, when I read it, the 100,000 BTU is sort of a magic number coming out of the small producer credit section, which is 024. And in 024, we identify who is a small producer credit or small producer for purposes of getting the 6 million credit that applies to Middle Earth. You have to not have more than 50,000 barrels of oil equivalent per average per day. And in order to get the other credit there, which is the $12 million, you have to be not more than 100,000 barrels of oil equivalent a day to qualify as a small producer there. So I think the 100,000 was intended to draw a line between the last person who could be a small producer and then the others, which presumably are non-small producers.
Okay. Representative Newman?
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add one thing to that. I mean, from
that would be Dan Dickens.
Very easy to see that currently there are three producers who would meet the qualification, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, and no other producer comes close.
So, if I can follow.
Representative Newman.
And so when we follow along with this, Marcia, where it says, notwithstanding any contrary provision law, which mostly has to deal with royalties, I believe, because that's what it talks about under Section E in 43, 55011 is E, and that's generally referred to several times over and over through taxes. A producer may not apply tax credits. But I believe House Bill 308 talks about applying tax credits, and earlier I asked you about what the gross is and how we went about that, and it's so after all development costs are done, and that's the gross value of that. Mm-hmm. So if you can't apply any tax credits, then those words right there would just about kill this bill, wouldn't it?
Representative Newman, through the chair, as I read this, what it's basically saying, the E is a reference to the 011 section, and E has two parts, the base tax and the progressivity tax.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
So it's the tax liability. And so what it's basically saying is, if you are, we'll call them large, just for easy, so people know what I'm talking about. If you have more than 100,000 barrels a day, we'll just say if you're a large producer, then it's basically saying your total tax liability under the production tax can, for your North Slope oil, your North Slope production, cannot be less than 10% of the gross value at the point of production. That's the first thing it says. The second thing it says is about credits, which is your question. It says that, and you can't, even if your tax liability were higher, in other words, under E, than this floor, you've got credits and you can use credits, but you can only draw down your tax liability to the point where you hit that floor of 10% of the gross value. So your credits can be used to take you down, but you don't get to take yourself down to zero. You stop when you get to 10% of the gross floor, and the credits you can't use then get carried forward.
I'm just going to read this amendment the way I understand it, as amended, and tell me where I'm right or wrong if you can. My interpretation. This subsection, what this would do is repeal Section 5 and 435511, which happens to be like 43 lines long. So it's pretty extensive. And it replaces it. And what it does is 435511 F is repealed and enacted, where actually F talks about the levy of tax under the section for oil and gas produced under North 68 degrees other than oil and gas subject to I, royalty, subject to the section may not be less than. And then it also goes back, because further down in the bill it talks about E and E1, which was in the amendment, which is the 25% production tax and progressivity, as you just mentioned. So this subsection applies to a taxpayer, basically the three largest producers on the North Slope. Notwithstanding any contrary provision of law, royalties, a producer may not apply a tax credit, the 0.4% credits available on after expenses, to reduce their producer's total tax liability, which was their total tax liability, so you can't use these credits on that. Under E of this section, for oil and gas produced from leases and properties, well, E is a 25% plus progressivity, and earlier when I asked you, that's the total taxes after things are done, so you can't, that tells me that you can't use these credits on any of those to reduce that any further. Mm-hmm. And then because within the unit or non-unitized air reservoir, that means all reservoirs, produced on all leases and properties, which would be all reservoirs, below 10% of the gross value at the point of production, or the wellhead, which is currently around $73, as you just testified on, if the calculated amount of the tax rate, it eliminates lines 10 to 11, and then it puts in there the production total liability for this section for all oil and gas leases and properties is less than 10% of the total scrotal value. So unless it's less than $7.30 at today's prices of the tax levied by E, which is the 25% plus progressivity, for all oil and gas equals less than 10% of the total gross value of the plant.
I'm sure there's a question.
I believe the way I kind of went through that, or the way I understand it, is because the total production value right now for oil is at $80, and you take off the $7 expenditure, you're at 73, so you can take off no more than $7.30 off of that for the total tax on that produced value.
Newman, you're close. You've identified correctly the $7.30 as being 10% of the gross value, but what that represents is the minimum tax that would be paid by one of these large producers for their production. So what it means is if ACES is higher, this doesn't get implicated. But if for some reason, if you calculate the tax liability using ACES, it can't fall below the 730. Likewise, you can't have a higher tax liability under ACES and then apply all your credits and draw it down to below 730. 730 will be the floor that would be paid on tax on those barrels at $80 West Coast price.
One more. I'll shut up for a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we look at, notwithstanding another contrary provision of law, which is royalty taxes, or royalties.
It would be the tax section, the production.
A producer may not apply tax credits to reduce the producer's total tax liability, and we talked about the total tax liability. So if you couldn't use the credits in the bill to reduce that, then that just kills 308. I think what the governor tried to intend too, I'm not quite sure, but you know, to try and allow construction or production credits. If you can't use production credits to apply them to your total tax liability.
Representative Newman, it isn't saying you can't use credits, you just can't use them to drive down the tax liability so that it ends up being less than $7.30 per barrel under your hypothetical.
Thank you.
Dan, do you read that the same way?
Yeah, I think Marcia has correctly characterized how this would work. And the only footnote I would have in here, and this may be something that can be corrected through a conceptual amendment or something, if you will notice in the law that it's replacing, it also talks about tax subject to I and tax subject to O. As this is currently framed, basically I believe you would end up putting a double tax on, for example, oil, gas used in the state because it's not exempted from one. But that's sort of a technicality because here you're comparing the liability under E against the total production, the total gross value at the point of production. So gross value at the point of production would include everything. The value under E does not include certain kinds of tax on the royalty portion of private royalties and gas use in state. It's a very minor point, very few dollars attached to it, but it's one correction.
Excuse me, Dan, when you say minor dollars attached to it, in this business, what are we talking? 100 million or 10 million or?
Mr. Chairman, no, because typically at $73, the floor typically wouldn't apply. What you're probably talking about is something more like, you know, if the world reverts to how it was, say, 10 years ago when you have oil prices in the $10 range. So when I say not a lot of money, I believe it's only going to occur when you have, you know, very low prices like the kinds you have for gas now. So, hundreds of thousands are all we're talking about. But for several small taxpayers, it's critical they would understand what their obligation was.
Okay, thank you. Representative Seaton, any additional? Is everyone clear on what this does? It takes the floor out. We share the upside, we give some of the upside, but we protect ourselves on the downside. And I think, and Dan, is that accurate? And the downside would be around $10?
Chair Johnson, obviously it's going to depend on several things,
right.
But it's going to be, I mean, mathematically, if you work this through, it's going to occur when your gross value at the point of a production is about 1.6 times your lease costs. So if current, you know, lease costs are, I'm just going to make some numbers up so I can do the things in my head, but very roughly speaking, are in the $20 range, you would trigger this kind of a provision when you were at 1.6 that or something like $32. So certainly the realm we're talking about, the world we're living in now of $70, this would not be triggered, but it certainly would be triggered earlier than $10.
Okay, so, okay, thank you. Representative Seaton, did you have something to add?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've been using a figure of maybe like $26 as the cost.
Right.
So there's no tax on a profits base due until you're $26. And then you would be looking at an amount of profit above that where 25% of that would equal the 10% of the gross value of production. And that's a figure that's a formula that could be worked out pretty easily.
Right.
But it's going to be obviously higher than $30 and probably less than 40 is my thumbnail.
Representative Seaton through the chair, but I think when that $26 figure has been used in a number of Department of Revenue publications, et cetera, the six is the gets you from the destination value in the lower 48 to your gross value at the point of production, and then the 20 has been the upstream cost. I think that's traditionally how those two have been divided up. But you're right, you can sit down and work it out mathematically.
And just for the record, the rest of the amendment on page 2, where you delete line 10 and 23. Those are conforming amendments and make no other substantive changes?
That's correct.
Mr. Seaton, Representative Seaton, would you say that louder?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I believe that everything from line 20 or 19 on page 2 are all just conforming amendments.
And any other questions about this? It protects us on the downside and gives a little bit on the upside. With that, I'll withdraw my objection. Are there any additional objections?
I object.
Representative Newman maintains his objection. Madam Clerk, would you call the roll?
Can I just speak to that real quick?
Well, hang on a second before you do. Representative Newman, would you like to speak to your maintaining the objection or
yes,
additional
Mr.
objection?
Chair. Just makes comments. You know, we discussed the floor ad nauseum, you know, and to a great extent, and why we did or did not do that. We spend days on that, you know, debating whether we should or should not and how it affects production, exploration, credits all over the state. And to just, you know, in 20 minutes of discussion in the Resource Committee, get rid of it, it's just not appropriate when, you know, as a body, we went ahead and decided that that's what we were going to do at the time. And to me, that's just not appropriate action. And so I strongly maintain my objection.
Representative Newman, thank you, and I appreciate that, but I assure you the body will act on this as a whole in some form or fashion, and I will look into this intently, but I at this point I don't have a terrible objection to it. So, Madam Clerk, would you call the roll?
This is on Amendment 4.
Amendment number 4.
As amended.
As amended. That's correct.
Okay, Amendment 4 as amended. Representative Guttenberg?
Yes.
Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Co-Chair Newman?
No.
Co-Chair Johnson?
Yes. Amendment number 4 has passed. Are there any additional amendments to come before us? And since we were so good, and I do want to compliment the committee on the 24 hours. I think everyone had these well within the 24 hours.
You didn't ask if there were any more amendments.
I'm not. Well, so I wanted to get the 24-hour thing out before I asked for any more. I just want to let you know I'm prepared to say no to them. Are there any additional amendments? Hearing and seeing none, I would like to go now to public testimony on this bill. Is there anyone on the line who'd like to testify? Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify? Having heard testimony from almost everyone,
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Actually, we never, Department of Revenue actually never got to testify. We were in the audience when Mr. Dickinson spoke to the bill, and I just wanted to make a couple comments on the overall bill.
I certainly would welcome the comments of the department.
We actually have a handout for today, and it's really, I'll only point at the last page because it's more informative, and it perhaps informs the vote that was taken on the whether there should be an adjustment to the minimum tax because there's been some adjustment on the upside.
Right.
And this the last page of this, page 5, captures what the upside is that we're shifting back to producers by virtue of just the progressivity change, because I don't think any of the amendments touched the progressivity today. And what we've done is the fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 09 calculations are based on actual data, and those are based on the monthly returns. And as you may recall, progressivity is calculated on the month. So these are actual, and the column that has the CSHB 308E was the original bill that called for just a change in progressivity from 0.4 to 0.2. That's the only thing it changed. The CSHB 308P, which is before you now, is the change in progressivity where they left alone the curve, the 0.4, and instead had it start after $30. So what you're able to see is the actuals for 08 and 09, the partial actual and estimate for 10, 11, and 12, and those are based on our fall 2009 revenue forecasts. So what you'll see is under the current bill you have in front of you, there are, those would be the reduction in current production tax revenues that the state would receive over either the actual or the forecasted.
And you're talking about a percentage, is that?
A percentage, okay. Yes, exactly. So for instance, in fiscal year 08, to the extent there was the actual dollar amounts in the column to the left. So you can see those in terms of millions of dollars. I wanted to put that there simply because the administration is under the governor is keen to give credits where, give away the value if we're going to get value either in form of increased production or increased job employment. And the change in progressivity in this bill is not necessarily tied to those elements. The other two areas that we had still outstanding concerns were on the interest rate. With the interest rate of this bill basically set at 3% above the Federal Reserve rate, with the reserve rate currently wavering between 0.5 and 0.75, we feel very much concerned that the state will become essentially not paid, that the revenues aren't going to flow in. At 3.75%, you've got a lot of companies out there that can't borrow money at that rate. And so if there are disputes or issues, they're going to hang on to the money and, you know, potentially make money on the difference. If the 11% is going to go away, and we can understand why that causes heartburn, perhaps adjusting that to 5% or something, at least nudging it up so that we get a little more into the realm where people feel less inclined to be bankers would be helpful. And then finally, the statute of limitations. I just wanted to give my personal appeal on the statute of limitations. I just came back from Anchorage, and I have an auditor who, and I received calls from an oil company who is very, very anxious to get their credits processed, cash out, and they are going from exploration development phase, beginning production. It's a wonderful, wonderful story, and they need the money flow, the cash flow to do it. Unfortunately, the auditor who has that account for that company is tied up trying to complete a 3-year statute of limitation, and he's got to get it out the door. So I have to tell the gentleman who would love to have his credits processed that he's going to have to wait. And I fear that if this law were to pass and all of my 6-year statute of limitations became 3 years, all of your best efforts and good efforts at creating credits and trying to get money flowing back out to investors is going to not be realized simply because I don't have the manpower to process the short 3-year turnarounds on on the audits and get the credits out because they're done by the same people. And, you know, we've talked about difficulty of, you know, I could hire more bodies if it were politically popular and, financially doable, but that doesn't seem to be happening right now. So I just caution you that you may be hurting your efforts at getting credits out into the pockets of producers right now if you shorten that statute of limitations. And those are the only comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Marcia. And I will look at that. And I am not wrapped around the axle on the statute of limitations. I would like to move this on, and I will commit to you to work with the Finance Committee if, in fact, this passes out, and arm wrestle or whatever it takes to make sure. We want to provide you with everything you need to do the job, and we certainly want to have the credits flow, and it would defeat the purpose of our legislation to keep the money in our pocket, not get it where it needs to be. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at your table here on 2010, that $300 million, was projected on the spring projection, or is that calculated on the actual prices through half of the year? What's that $300 million?
Were you referencing fiscal year 2010, Representative Seaton? That represents a partial actual for 2010. The monthly data I believe we have is, frankly, I think that is only through January. It's 1 month of actual data, and then the other 11 months are what were forecasted for fall 2009.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
So, Mr. Chairman, I guess we have $1.7 billion plus for looking at the way that this would have reduced our revenue for just in the actual past 3 years. And
Representative Seaton, I don't know that you can make that comparison because these are comparisons between the two versions of the bill, not what we actually made if things would have continued on.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that this is a comparison between ACES, which is on the far left. There's no difference between that because there's no differences. And so this is a comparison between ACES and 308E or 308P. So 308E.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. I stand corrected, Representative Seaton.
Okay, so we have a minimum of $1.7 billion, and I'm not seeing any. We haven't had these credits looked at as to how much those would have also reduced the state revenue. So, it seems to me that we're well over $2 billion in revenue decrease by what 308 would do. And so, Mr. Chairman, I think that that's until, we haven't identified at all going what we would have been willing to cut out. Were we going to cut out forward funding of education? Were we going to cut out the university capital constructions and those things that if we reduced our, had reduced our revenue for at least $1.7 billion? So,
Representative Seaton, I think that would mean we'd only have $11 billion in reserve as opposed to the $12 billion that we have. So I don't think we're talking about cutting anything by doing this.
Well,
we're talking about having less surplus.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you're talking about the surplus being the forward funding of education, that is part of what you're calling the surplus. We have just this year finally repaid what we owed the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And so when we're talking about things that we could sweep out, such as AHFC and those things, that's true. But I need to look more at the economic impact of this. So,
and Representative Seaton, you will certainly have that opportunity. We're certainly not done with this. It will go to finance and it will go to the floor, and there will be in the finance they will be looking at that considerably in depth. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I think we need more information, so I'm going to move to table.
There has been a tabling motion. And that is non-debatable. So with that, I would the secretary call the roll, or the clerk call the roll, and this is to table HB 308.
Any no vote?
A no vote would mean that we continue to hear the bill.
Okay, motion is to table. Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Tuck?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Edgman?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg?
Yes.
Represent- Representative Wilson?
No.
Co-Chair Newman?
No.
Co-Chair Johnson?
No.
Five yea, four nay.
So with that, the debate on 308 is done until we can bring it back before us. So with that, we are adjourned.